Stefan Bertram, and I'm joined by Ben Burgess, and this is Philosophy for the People. We were late in doing the logistics of this episode because Jean is a father and I was drinking on the beach. So we decided to be just to be slightly more late than we were before. Ben, would you rather answer the question of who is the most beautiful woman in the world, or would you rather answer the question of are Marxist Gnostics?
let's see. I guess given that choice, I haven't done a thorough survey on the first question. I mean, I guess now that I'm single again, I'll work on it. But
I think it's likely that this woman would be Gnostic.
Yes. because she'd be a Marxist, and Marxists apparently are Gnostics. Yeah, this is the weirdest fucking thing, but there's like a little corner of the most online section of the right wing that has decided that Marxism is a Gnostic religion, and sometimes there seems to be a suggestion that it's like also literally satanic, although that's confusing.
I mean,
because I think one of the main promulgators, James Lindsay, is like, I think, still officially an atheist.
By the way, everyone, for the whole 20 minutes before we started, the LAPD were not like surrounding Ben's home.
For fuck's sake, what the hell?
So the actual topic of today is multiverse stuff. Several kinds of multiverse stuff, and I think the thing to first establish once I unmute Ben and hope the LAPD have stopped, is to kind of distinguish between all these different kinds of possible multiverses.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was actually the LAFD. I saw a couple of fire trucks going by. But whatever's on fire isn't here. putting aside the is Marxism Gnostic question, which, you know,
for later, not putting it away, merely moving it to the side for future essays on. I mean, this is the closest I've been to demanding an essay. I need an essay on Gnostic James Lindsay.
Fair enough. So so while we wait for that one to be written, so the essay this week comes out of a panel that I did with Paul Horwich and Tasneem Hussain.
But Sabine Hossfender wasn't there in the end.
No, she was not. I don't actually remember if there was a version of the program that had her on there or not, but yeah, those were the two other people who were on it. Called The Best of the Worst of Possible Worlds, which had to do with different kinds of suggestions of possible or alternate worlds. And yeah, I think it's useful to break down a couple of different kinds. There's one that we're going to, talk about a little bit of this essay. We could talk about a little bit today, but I'll talk about much more next week. And then there's the kind that, you know, pretty much talked about for the bulk of this one, right? So one is there's basically physics-y alternate realities. And then the other one is there's, you know, metaphysics-y alternate realities. So physics-y alternate realities are things like, for example, the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. So the kind of dominant view about quantum physics, the Copenhagen interpretation, says that at the level of subatomic, you know, particles, that there's not everything's totally deterministic, that there's that some things are like objectively probabilistic, that even if you knew everything there was to know about the laws of physics and you knew everything there was to know about, you know, the current state, except that we can use that phrase of the particles, you would only know in a probabilistic way, right, what the chance was, right, that the that, you know, I don't know, the two slit experiment, the, you know, particles were going to go through the one slit or the other slit or whatever. That's the, that's kind of the received view. But there's this other view about quantum physics that, you know, many physicists would subscribe to, that says no, it's all deterministic. It's just that the different
we don't see the other stuff because they're happening somewhere else in a different world.
Exactly.
Like the idea is that the Schrodinger equation basically says that all of this, all the possible outcomes happen, and then all the other theories of quantum mechanics are trying to make sense of that in our world, where only one happens. And then many worlds are like, but what if it was actually true?
Yeah, exactly. It's all happening, just not all at the in the same world. There's also a view that I'm going to do a worse job of explaining than that, because I have a worse handle on it, which is about cosmology. You know, bubble universes, where you say that that the process that, you know, that generates our world, you know, from the Big Bang onwards, is essentially just one, you know, bubble in some metaphorical cosmic foam, that like there are all these other, you know, there are all these other universes being generated by the same process, and so these are both examples of what I'm very just like crassly referred to in the essay as multiverse physics, because like the details of different kinds of theories that we could call multiverse theories don't matter too much for any purposes that I'm using them for. It's just like, hey, here are various ways in which physicists, some theoretical physicists, think that there might be some sort of alternate realities alongside our own. And this is roughly what there's a sort of bastardized version of being portrayed in Hollywood movies, where wherein you can actually like travel back and forth between the different, you know, realities, which, as was noted in the description for the panel, there's been kind of a craze for in the last few years,
which is very conceptually interesting, right? That we're kind of obsessed with these alternate. I mean, we discussed it before and talked about it in the sense of like comic books, how with comic books, basically due to the fact that they have this like small cast, they need to exist for like 80 years, but occasionally they do need to like make one of them die at some point. They really start to lean on this idea of, well, what if X-Man from Universe 2.7 came here?
Yeah, so I mean, the kind of conceit has been used in, yeah, as you say, in comic books and like, I mean, whatever, the Star Trek episode where there was the evil dimension where everybody had a mustache was in the 1960s. But yeah, there has been like a real craze for it recently. Certainly think about, you know, like just in the last year or two, there's the movie whose name I was playing off of for the title of this essay, Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, you know, I actually was actually one of the is one of the only Marvel movies that I actually like, because it's directed by Sam Raimi and it shows. It sort of feels like a horror movie in the MCU. But there's, you know, there's also and, you know, sticking with comic book movies, there was the Into the Spider-Verse, and now Across the Spider-Verse. There's the obviously Everything Everywhere All at Once, you know, was like a more sort of prestigious version. It was, you know, nominated for a zillion Oscars and stuff. So yeah, there's like a lot of this, there's a lot of this around. And so that's the stuff again that you're getting, you know, I think the boring truth is that if there is the sort of multiverse that various kinds of theories and physics would tell you that there is, sadly, you know, it's probably not the kind of thing that you can travel around.
Right. They're going to be either completely like causally disconnected or insanely far away.
Yeah. Yeah. So the, so any kind of causal connection that you get would be just kind of in terms of the backstory, right? Like in the Bubble Universe version, is the, you know, the same process is bringing about, you know, both of them. But once they, you know, once the different universes get going, right, there's no causal connection between them. So yeah, that's the so all that stuff is the stuff we're sort of lumping together into this category of the multiverse. And that's as opposed to the metaphysics-y kinds of possible worlds, which are postulated just to solve like conceptual problems about how to think about language and truth and stuff like that.
I should mention at this point, this essay is, as I found out, mostly about fine-tuning.
Yeah. Yeah. So in, you know, originally it was going to be about both. But then I, you know, I kind of thought, yeah, let's keep these same lengths, and split it up. Right. So yeah, this essay is like about half of it. A third of it is sort of laying out, here are different kinds of, you know, here are different kinds of alternate realities that people think might exist. And the sort of overarching claim of the essay is that, look, if there are any, I mean, who knows? There could be, but we would need to like show that scientifically, that you can't just like make philosophical arguments to show that any sort of alternate realities exist. And so part of that is sort of going through what the different options are of different kinds of alternate realities. Part of that is saying, okay, you know, let's kind of lay down a marker of like, here's why I don't like the sort of metaphysics-y kinds of possible worlds. And we'll explore that more next week. And then part of it is, okay, well, how about the physics-y kinds of possible worlds? I mean, those are fine if you believe in them for physics-y reasons, but what about, metaphysics-y reasons to believe in the physics-y kinds of alternate realities? And that's where the cosmological fine-tuning stuff comes in, because that's the sort of philosophical reason that, you know, avoiding fine-tuning arguments is the sort of philosophical reason for you know, like wanting some kind of multiverse hypothesis to be true. And, you know, I've talked a lot more about that elsewhere, but I mean, the point here is just like, no, guys, like, this really doesn't give you a very good reason to think this is true.
I mean, I agree that it doesn't really, as a reply to the fine-tuning argument, it doesn't really make any sense. But I'm just really interested in the fine-tuning argument, as it's one of those where I just don't get it. Like, because it's like, you know, it is quite plausible that among all kinds of sets of possible physical arrangements, the ones where people like us emerge is quite low, and even any life at all, because, you know, maybe 99.99% of universes with random constants don't have mass which clumps. And if you don't have kind of like a uneven distribution of energy, you can't have life. Or so we think. And partly I do think it's like, you know, people aren't imaginative enough about how life could form, but probably if there's no energy distribution, kind of unevenness, clumpiness and that sort of thing, you probably couldn't have any form of anything to do with life. But the thing is, in there's an observer effect, right? That, yeah, maybe universes in which I exist are very unlikely in the grand scheme of things. But observe when universes which observers like me observe, 100% of them are going to be ones where observers like me can exist, right?
Yeah.
And maybe that's me already swallowing this multiverse stuff because I'm thinking of possible worlds, but...
Yeah, so that's the, you know, roughly the idea here. So, I mean, okay, so maybe the metaphysics of possible worlds we could bracket and, you know, get back to because that's kind of the preview for next week anyway. But you know, thinking about reasons why... somebody might think that there's a multiverse. So there's a, like, I think the kind of move that you just made in response to the, you know, the fine-tuning argument is one that that people, that like some people think is sort of easier to make if you think there is a multiverse. So we should back up just a minute here and just say, so, you know, for anybody who's not familiar with this phrase, right, the fine-tuning argument is the argument that says, it's an argument for the existence of God that says, well, okay, look, you have all these different, you have all these basic physical constants, like gravity, that if they were just ever so slightly different, we couldn't exist, and nothing like us could exist. And when we say nothing like us could exist, like really, like nothing, like even remotely like us could exist. It's not like instead of us, there could be one of the alien species from Star Trek or something. They couldn't exist either if any of these things were a little bit different. So the you know metaphor that I use in the essay is you think of physical constants, you know, with force of gravity as dials, right? You know, if the dial was
on the grill.
Yeah, exactly.
The only thing I think which has dials in my life anymore is the oven.
Yeah, there you go. So, right, so picture that.
Fucking up a universe, bro.
Exactly. But instead of the you know, instead of the different dials controlling different burners on the oven, they're all somehow just controlling different aspects of one. And so if you think about exactly where the dial is set, you have all these dials where if one of the, you know, if it was just a little bit to the left, just a little bit to the right, nothing like us could exist. And and for basically for anything like us to exist, you have a bunch of dials where they all have to be set exactly where they are. And so, you know, the scene I brought up in the essay, you know, is there's this fun scene in Everything Everywhere All at Once where two of the characters are, their like minds are inhabiting two rocks in this barren landscape in this universe that can't support life. And one of them says to the other, yeah, most universes are like this. But of course, you know, which is fun, right? Although I think in a lot of these cases, like I think maybe you couldn't even have the rocks, right? You know,
right, because that's like matter clumping and uneven energy distribution. So, and that's like great for life compared to other possibilities where you have like a flat universe, which is, yeah, of course, exactly, where our universe is heading in the end.
Right, of course.
Thinking about it, if you take the universe on like a long enough time scale, does that mean basically it rounds up to 100% of our universe being completely impossible for life?
Yeah, so the so I think roughly the thought is, okay, if you're imagining that there isn't a cosmic fine tuner, you know, standing there, you know, making sure, okay, this one should be set just so, this next dial should be set just so. Instead, you're imagining metaphorically that all of the all of the dials are just kind of being spun at random. And this is a one-time occurrence, right? It's and it, like the one and only time all the dials go for a spin at once. They all just happen to land at exactly where they need to land. The exact combination of each one being exactly where it needs to be for there to be life. That sounds incredible. And, you know, and I will say, like, I mean, I feel the force of this one, like that all of the other arguments for the existence of God, more or less, like, you know, they sort of feel to me like, yeah, there are indeed birds out here, behind.
A particularly annoying one started up, but it's interesting. We've talked about this before, that you, what's the one I like? Yeah, cosmological, like first cause yeah. arguments, which you aren't really a fan of. Well, I see nothing in fine tuning. Well, that's the one that makes the most sense to you.
Yeah. So yeah, I think, you know, first cause arguments, I think, you know, it just sort of feels a little bit like a kind of verbal argumentative trick to me. It's never, it doesn't really feel that compelling. I mean, I can kind of, actually wrote about this last week that, you know, I can kind of get to the point like where I can sort of make myself feel the force of like, okay, wouldn't it be incredibly weird if you have all the chains of causation just go back forever. Okay, fair enough. That does feel pretty weird.
I mean, I guess the song that's
similar. It also feels pretty weird if it stops somewhere
yeah.
and there's like a cause that nothing causes. And I think the argument feels to me like it really relies on sort of focusing on the strangeness of the first one and kind of not really thinking too hard about the strangeness of the second one, or maybe taking the strangeness of the second one as the jumping off point for feelings of religious awe or something like that.
I mean, I guess maybe the thing that's similar about them is that if you don't, basically the alternative to believing that kind of the first cause is God, the only kind of good naturalistic explanation, and it's not a good one, but maybe that's just the truth, is that it was like a brute cause. You know, the brute fact that there's nothing more about it that can be said. And that could also be true to explain why our universe's laws are the way they are. If you don't believe in fine-tuning, it's to say it's just like a brute fact. So maybe that's the thing that they find they're similar in, and we're just kind of, one brute fact bothers us more than the other one does.
Yeah, no, that could be. So I think that, when I like think about the sort of sheer improbability of conditions for life existing, like, you know, obviously I'm not ultimately persuaded by it, but I mean, like, that's, you know, that's the one that maybe gives me a bit of pause. And the sort of move, the multiverse solution to this is to say, well, look, if we're not imagining it, all of the dials going for a spin at once, only once, and just happens that the one time this happens, it comes up, they all come up exactly where they need to. If instead of that, we're imagining, you know, a million spins, then like, okay, sure. Like in all of those, you'll get one, right? That is exactly where they are in our universe, and it makes, you know, and it's like saying, so there's actually a comment that somebody who disagreed with me, but, you know, I thought it was a good comment, left on the essay today, where they said, you know, it's like saying, okay, it's very unlikely that you'll get, you know, the right, you know, oxygen on any given planet, but given just how many planets there are, it's not surprising that you get one that does. And and that's what we would be on. And it's the same kind of move for that. It's like, yeah, if you have an infinite number of dial spins, right, then sure, you know, like every once in a very great while, right, doesn't, you know, it might be fantastically improbable, you know, one over some brain meltingly large denominator, but whatever, it just takes one. And I think to a lot of people, rightly or wrongly, I don't totally know what I think about that, but a lot of people think that this sort of move that you just made makes more sense if you assume that, say, okay, well, look, they're all the different, you know, that the why are we in this one isn't really that compelling a question. But, you know, in the same way that why would this one be the only one that exists would be a compelling question.
Right. And I guess I think the whole thing is complicated by the fact, I'm just bringing up this comment, by the fact that basically all of us aren't necessitarians. And this is kind of the connection, right, between kind of worrying about the fine-tuning argument and talking about possible worlds, that we generally don't think in a strong sense that the past was inevitable. Like maybe physically, deterministically, it was inevitable. That's a common thought. But in a metaphysical sense, it's not thought to be inevitable. Like there could be other ways things could have gone.
Yeah. So I mean, talking about necessity here is tricky. I mean, especially thinking about the origins of the universe, because like usually when you think about like, you know, necessity in terms of like determinism, like what we're thinking is, well, given the initial setup, like given the initial way that the world is, there's only one way that it could be in the future. But it's not maybe totally obvious how that maps onto the idea that there was only one, like it seems like you're at least working with some other idea of necessity if you say that, like, well, the initial conditions were the only way these the initial conditions could be.
Right. But, I mean, just to bring it up in the context of, you know, the fact that we constantly use counterfactuals in our day-to-day life.
Yeah.
And especially right. past facing counterfactuals.
Yeah, totally. So we've been talking about the multiverse stuff, but yeah, I mean, certainly thinking about, you know, metaphysics and kinds of possible worlds, like part of the motivation there is that we all think, come on, like we all think that there's some sense in which, okay, X happened, but it was possible that Y could have happened instead. You know, even if like nobody's a like even if you're a total determinist, like so you think, well, okay, that's not possible in this given the exact initial conditions and the exact laws of physics and everything. No, there are no birds; those are in your head. Should aggressively gaslight the audience for this. you're just crazy. No, I am sitting out on the porch of my new apartment in Los Angeles. There are indeed birds chirping in the background. But yeah, so we clearly think there's some sense in which, X happened, but Y could have, you know, happen instead. And we certainly think we can make sense of saying things like, you know, if I, you know, I don't know, if like all I had to drink today was water, that we can make sense of saying things like, well, if I'd been drinking coffee instead of water, I'd be less tired.
Yeah.
Right. That like everybody thinks, nobody I think really denies that there's some sense in which that sentence is true, that even if you think we live in a totally deterministic universe that, you know, from the Big Bang onwards, there was zero chance that I would drink coffee instead of water. We still think that there's some sense in which, okay, if I had the coffee instead of the water, I'll be less tired. And so thinking about sentences like this, I think, gives you one of the sort of big motivations for believing in possible worlds in the philosophical sense. And there's like more and less sort of metaphysically extravagant things that people could mean by possible worlds. But roughly, you think, okay, a sentence like that, you know, if I'd been drinking coffee instead of water, I would be less tired. We think that, like, one way of understanding that is in the possible worlds that are like otherwise like this one, where I drank coffee instead of water.
There are other possible worlds in which Ben has a table inside.
Yeah, this is not a long-term solution, but it is very nice.
Ben actually conspired to make it so the show wasn't on time by posting irrelevant stuff in the chat, and that was all to conceal, so to show off his bird song to as few people as possible.
Yeah. No, exactly. Yeah. this world that we're living in is the actual world, and there are different possible worlds, and what it means to say that something could have happened is at least one possible world where it did happen. What you mean when you say something was necessary, it couldn't have not happened, is that in every possible happens. When you say that if X was true, Y would be true, you're saying, well, in the closest possible worlds, right, the ones, in other words, most otherwise similar to us, where X is true, Y is also true, that's the view. Now, there are a couple different things you could mean by possible worlds. And, you know, one way of using the phrase possible worlds, which is like Saul Kripke's way of using it, is, well, a world in Kripke's sense is just a set of propositions, a complete set of propositions. So in other words, every question is answered one way or the other. So for the question, you know, did I drink a cup of coffee earlier? Either the proposition that I did or the proposition that I didn't will be included in the world. So a complete, consistent set of propositions. That's the Kripke's way of using the phrase possible worlds. So the actual world is the complete, consistent set of propositions that's true, and the other possible worlds are just all the other.
It does feel like a real philosopher's solution to the problem, which I don't think anyone would come to otherwise, where the world becomes a set of propositions, as in, actually, I could just write down the whole world in my little book.
Yeah. But this also, so Kripke's style possible worlds do let you do some of the things that you want to do with possible worlds talk, but they don't do everything that you might want to do with possible worlds talk. So the more robust, interesting, insane, perhaps, version of possible worlds is the David Lewis kind, which is what I'm really interested in for this essay, the follow-up next week. So David Lewis thinks, no, a world isn't something you write down in your notebook. A world, even if it was an infinite notebook, you had an infinite amount of time, right? Like, that still wouldn't be a world, right? Like, a world is, you know, one of these. A spatio-temporal thing, you know, that like the one we live in. So
concrete objects.
Yes. A world is this complete set of causally interconnected concrete objects, such as the one in which we actually live. And so David Lewis, so he wrote, well, one book that was kind of about this, one book that was completely about this, the one's completely about this is called On the Plurality of Worlds. And he has this very famous phrase in there about how says, look, I can refute every argument you can give me against this, but I don't know how to refute an incredulous stare. And the reason that this is a view that tends to inspire incredulous stares is that you, when he explains, no, I really mean when I say that what it means that something could have been true is that there's some possible world in which it is true. What I really mean is a world like this one, that I am asserting the existence of all of these different spatio-temporal worlds that are real in exactly the same way that this world is real. And sure, this is the actual world.
They're the kind of the most extreme version of like a Canadian girlfriend in the sense that they're completely causally locked off.
Yes. Well, so there's actually, so there's a philosopher named Neil Sinibabu who once wrote a paper called Possible Girls, where he essentially this connection, but that he's got this whole view according to which it's actually possible to date across possible worlds. I think maybe Neil, by his own admission, was very lonely when he wrote this paper. But in any case, so these worlds are real in exactly the same way this one is. And sure, we might say this is the actual world, those are just possible worlds. But on Lewis's way of using these terms, that's no different from saying, like, okay, 2023 is now and 1623 is then, but that just means 2023 is the year in which I am uttering this sentence. It's not really a metaphysical distinction. Or if I say...
It's an indexical.
Yeah, exactly, right? If I say Los Angeles is here and you know Hong Kong is there, I'm not attributing some special metaphysical property of here-ness to Los Angeles that Hong Kong lacks. I'm just saying that's the one I'm in as I'm saying this sentence. Exactly, it's an indexical. So indexicals are words like I, here, now, right? And for Lewis, actual is like that. That when I say this is the actual world, all I really mean is it's the one that I'm in, right? It's the one in which I'm uttering this sentence. And that's, you know, in every other sense, right? They're, you know, so the possible world just means it's a world other, you know, possible but not actual world just means it's a, you know, it's a possible world other than the one in which I'm uttering this sentence. And just to sort of quickly give people a sense of why on earth anybody would believe this.
I mean, I'm wondering then, too.
Sure. I mean, you know, fair question. Something I'd actually be really fascinated if I met the person who was like, oh yeah, fair enough. No follow-up questions. I totally understand why, you know, David Lewis from his philosophical armchair just decided that this was true. So there are a couple of problems that this is supposed to solve conceptually. So one of them is just like to sort of give an analysis of what we mean by possibility and necessity and all that. So if you want to define possibility and necessity in terms of possible worlds, then the Saul Kripke version of possible worlds talk isn't going to help you very much because, well, this is the way the argument goes anyway, that the Saul Kripke possible worlds, part of what defines them as well, it's a complete and consistent set of propositions, but hold on, complete and consistent are themselves modal concepts. In other words, they're already concepts about possibility and necessity, right? You're saying, oh, there's nothing that could be added to it. That means it's complete. Or, you know, it's you're saying two things are inconsistent. You're saying they couldn't both be true. So the claim is that we haven't really, like, if we try to define possibility in terms of possible worlds, and we define possible worlds as complete and consistent sets of propositions, then we've sort of gone around in a circle. We haven't really defined anything. That's one argument. Another argument is that think about truth. Most of us, most of the time, probably, even if we don't have the terminology, believe in something like the correspondence theory of truth that says that propositions are true just as long as they match up with the way that external reality is. So I say, the cat is on the mat, and that's true if and only if, out there in three-dimensional physical concrete reality, right, the cat is indeed on the mat. Or even if I say something that I have no idea whether it's true or not, Alexander the Great's paternal grandmother once had a splinter in the big toe on her right foot when she was 6 years old. I have no clue whether that's true. I'm never going to know whether it's true, short of inventing a time machine. I don't know how anybody could hope to figure it out. But presumably, we think it's either true or false, and we think it's true if she did, right? And it's false if she didn't. But then you start thinking about sentences like Alexander the Great could have got the plague and died before he became king.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be true, but hold on, what makes it true? I mean, there's no, like, if you think of truth as something, even anything like correspondence to reality, what's the reality that it's corresponding to?
Right.
And that's a bit of a mystery otherwise. And, there are other ways you could, try to answer that question. But one very straightforward way, a la Lewis, is to say...
It fucking happened, man. That... It happened. It all happened. All in the David Lewis's Multiverse of Madness. It all happened.
Yeah, exactly, right? But it's like, no, what makes that true is that there is this... There's the spatio-temporal real world in which that happened. I mean, it's a fun view. I am very thoroughly unpersuaded by it, but that's the sort of point, that I was making this week. I mean, I kind of, got into the David Lewis possible world sort of just enough to say, okay, here's what they are, and here's, in a view from 10,000 feet kind of way, why I don't like them, before going on to the physicist's multiverse. But the very general reason I don't like them is that I don't think that this is the kind of thing that you can establish through philosophical argumentation. I think that philosophy is great. I love it. Philosophical arguments can do many excellent things, but one thing that they really shouldn't be able to do is to show you that the other 99.9999999% of physical reality you didn't know about exists.
I am really generally sus of multiplication of entities, like more than you probably should be. Like Occam's razor doesn't matter that much compared to just somebody having better arguments. But, many worlds says that it might be either like a really, really big finite number or an infinite number of possible worlds. Many worlds. The Lewis thing, I think the infinity there, because it definitely would be infinite, I'm pretty sure. And I think it's an infinity of a different cardinality. Like, I think it's you know, when you say 99.99%, it's not true in the sense that you probably should just say 100.
Yeah. Actually do say the 99.99% thing in the essay, then have a little footnote say that, like, technically that's wrong, because presumably there's a number of them, and infinities don't work like that. You can't express in percentages the relationship between two infinities that would even have the same cardinality. You can map them on one-to-one, so all that's confusing, but also I think you know what I mean. I think Lewis has responses to the Occam's razor thing.
He's dead, right?
Yeah. Lewis is, let's see. He died in several years ago, I think. Oh, yeah, more than several years. I'm old, so I think of this as several years ago. But objectively speaking, half of my life ago.
What was it, 2008?
Keep going. So long time ago.
Just after 9/11. Cool beard he had, though.
Great beard. Saul Kripke, who we were just talking about, actually just died, last fall. Lewis has been, in this world, has been dead for a long time. So he had all these responses to the multiplication of entities worry. So one of the sort of key ones is to say, well, multiplication of entities kinds of worries, the Occam's razor stuff, that should only matter for kinds of entities. For example,
virtually all those kinds of entities feature in the total set of entities that he's talking about.
Well, so his claim would be that, for example, ontological simplicity, that sort of idea you shouldn't multiply entities beyond necessity. You know, he doesn't think that would give us a reason to prefer monotheism to polytheism, because we're just talking about the same kind of entity. And similarly says, you already believe in one world. So I'm not saying, there's not a new kind of entity here. We're just talking about a bunch of other, bunch of others of these same kinds of things that you already believe in. So the ontological simplicity shouldn't enter into it. And that's it. It's a clever response. I'm not sure I totally think that puts the worry to bed. It seems to me that intuitively we do apply those kinds of simplistic considerations to entities that might in some sense be of the same kind as ones we already believe in. And it's also I think a lot is going to depend on exactly how much you massage that word kind, right? So I'm thinking here about Russell's teapot, is this classic illustration where you say you imagine this giant teapot that's orbiting in space in just the right position, that it's not going to be picked up by any of our instruments. We shouldn't believe in that, because it'd be simpler to assume that there isn't one, right? But we believe in teapots. Maybe not, giant teapots orbiting in space, but that's a question of how to split up the kinds,
I think that the teapot thing is probably one of the most abused things online.
Sure.
Where kind of atheists, and I think it's a great source of atheists and theists talking past each other, because atheists are what about the pot? And theists are we've got arguments and shit. Yo.
Yeah, there's a kind of you know, I think it's a, you know, I guess I'd have to go back and look at the original context, but it seems to me like there's a, like there is, like there's a kind of argument in which, for which like the teapot thing, like makes sense to me. It's like,
yeah, like an appeal to mystery or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, you know, I think, but so if the question is like, hey, if you accept the premise that there's like zero compelling evidence for theism, then what should your attitude be? Should you be an atheist? Should you be an agnostic? Mm. You know, whatever. Then I think this sort of teapot thing might like be a good intuition pump for like, no, you think, like, you know, this kind of simplistic considerations do have at least a little bit of force.
Yeah, no, like, I mean, I'm good with anything which can be used to further smash on agnostics.
Yeah.
The dirty fence sitters.
Yeah, exactly.
The dirty principled fence sitters. They're sitting on that fence and they're principled about it.
That's right. Yeah, give me a good, honest fundamentalist any day. Yeah, so, I mean, it's
I walked past
the... What's that?
Go on.
Oh, you know, I mean, the version of this I'd always do is like a obnoxious young man having this argument is that say, look, imagine that I claim that, you know, on the palm of my hand right now there's a tiny invisible leprechaun that's dancing around singing Danny Boy at a frequency that human ears can't hear, and if you go like this, he'll teleport into an alternate dimension just in time. All right. Are you going to be an agnostic about whether there's a leprechaun, right? Or are you going to actively believe that there is no leprechaun? So I think
I'd call my mom and be like, "Mom, there's a schizophrenic here."
Exactly. And you're not like, now to be clear, it's possible that in an amazing coincidence, his delusions are accurate, but, you know, I'm reserving judgment. Who knows? No, I don't think you would reserve judgment. I think you would actively actively believe that this was false. So I think that's like maybe a good anti-agnostic argument, but I agree with you. It's actually like this whole thing I've been encountering actually like much more since I started to write this Substack, is this whole subculture of online atheists who are really like militantly opposed to the idea that there are any arguments for the existence of God that they need to take seriously, even to debunk them. And it's the weirdest fucking thing. I don't understand it at all. I mean, like, my primary interaction with the subject over the course of my life has been teaching intro to philosophy classes where I talk about arguments for the existence of God. And I, you know, I think, you know, I sort of think of in that context, right? I mean, not in the wider world where, you know, I don't really, you know, give a shit particularly what people's metaphysical beliefs are as long as they, you know, believe in the separation of church and state. But in the context of arguing about philosophy, I sort of think of myself as like pretty militantly atheistic, but then like, you know, I'm such a squish compared to these people because like I'm like, no, I mean, obviously you need to like actually think through what's wrong with all these arguments and give good responses and all this stuff. And they're like, what arguments? Like they have, like it seems to be very important to their self-conception that there's no evidence for the existence of God. Not like insufficient evidence or like evidence that ultimately we should reject or something like that, but that there just like cannot be literally any evidence or their own sort of understanding of how this dialectic works and where they fit in and it collapses.
Which is a really fragile position, right? Like one which you can end up, you know, falling.
Yeah, because you end up actually accidentally listening to somebody for too long, and you'll realize that like no, that's not right. Right? I mean, like there are, you know, I mean, and
the refuge is normally for them to say that, you know, any argument that anyone presents is just kind of about God and not about God. Like, as in the difference between like the abstract God of philosophical arguments and the more concrete theism, which just feels a bit like, well,
okay,
you know, mate, if he made the world and he's all good and he's all powerful, there's probably some church you should be following, mate.
Yeah, I mean, that's also really weird because it's like, come on, I mean, you're an atheist. You clearly don't believe in that God either. It's not just that you don't believe in, you know, the God of the Bible, but I mean, it's like, no, you also don't believe in the sort of vague God, right? Like, this is surely part of what you're talking about. But yeah, it's and like, really, I mean, if you think about like what we normally mean by evidence, you know, that like something is evidence for theory T if it, you know, it like raises the probability of T being true, then it's like, come on, like, really, like, none, literally, there's like literally nothing that if you consider just that at one point, it increases the probability. Like, why, and you know, why would that be important? But like, I think it's something that makes, I think it's something that starts to make sense when you realize that there's like a kind of online atheist whose entire relationship to atheism is that they just really, really enjoy making fun of religious people. And that's like their sort of posture from which they want to do it, you know, like isn't really compatible with like saying that you have to actually like get down on all fours and start looking at the arguments.
My thing I was going to say earlier about, I was walking past an evangelical church on the way back to my house, and they had like the sound of the guy pumping out on the street. And amazingly, the one sentence I caught was him saying, "You're actually worse than you think you are," which was just brilliant and lovely. So Ben, what's next week? Because it's very closely related to what this week is, and possibly we've accidentally covered it today.
The sort of general, like, coming out of the panel, I mean, my general claim about all this is that there really is no good way to establish, just with philosophical arguments or even with philosophical arguments playing a particularly significant role, that there are any sort of alternate realities. I should say, because we kind of skipped over this earlier, that the reason I don't find the reason I don't find the avoiding the fine-tuning argument for a multiverse particularly compelling is mostly just that I think it's redundant. I don't think we need it. I think that one way of seeing why I think it's redundant is that, even when I said earlier that, you know, when I just start to think about the sort of, you know, mind-numbing improbability of the conditions for life existing in the one universe where it would exist, and this is the sort of one argument for, you know, a creator that, you know, that can kind of give me pause. But it's like, part of, I think, the trick here is, like, whether or not life exists seems really, really important. And it just seems like obviously the kind of thing that a cosmic fine tuner would care about. Mm-hmm. But like, why? Right? I mean, like, that, I mean, it's not a mystery why it'd be really important to us, right? I mean, it's the most important thing to us. It's whether there can be us. But like, but why would it be, you know, if you're talking about a purely hypothetical being who you know, this is an argument pitched at somebody who doesn't already think that there's a good reason to believe in the existence of that being. Well, look, that hypothetical being could care about anything. They could care about life, sure, but they could care about, it could be that they're totally indifferent to whether or not there's life, and they're really concerned with whether there's the number of atoms in the universe is a prime number. They're really
we are just a byproduct of someone's cool rock collection.
Yeah, exactly. Right, like that seems ridiculous, but it's because we're imagining because what we're really doing, I mean, is when we think about this, is we're just unthinkingly jumping to the conclusion that if there was a being powerful enough to create universes according to their will, that being would share our values. And I'm not really sure why, right? I mean, that being could value anything.
I mean, we share our own values, right? But we often make universes which are just rocks knocking into each other on our computer.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, what? Why is it there? The fact that this universe exists, it was so improbable, is some evidence for the existence of a fine tuner who cares about life. But it's also some evidence, the fact that this universe as opposed to any of the other universes exist is evidence against a fine tuner whose passion is to maximize the number of black holes that exist. Because they easily could have, there's so many other universes that would have more black holes than this one. I mean, like,
in the grand scheme of things, this universe is not life at all.
No, well, that's also true, right? That it's like that really what this universe existed as evidence for is a fine tuner who cares about life, but only a little bit.
Yeah.
who likes life, but doesn't like it so much that they're not going to create a universe that's 99.999999% lifeless.
Yeah.
They like just a little life as a treat, right? It's better to have most of creation be completely dead. So the thing is, once you internalize that point, that's like, look, a hypothetical creator could have any goals. The fact that we live in a universe that has these and no others doesn't particularly move me to think that there was a universe that there was a fine tuner who happened to have this goal who created the universe, because there could be a fine tuner who happened to have any other goal the fact that so. To the extent that this universe existed as opposed to any of the other possible combinations of dial settings, to the extent that that's an argument for the existence of a fine tuner who has the goal of a little bit of life, it's also evidence against the existence of a fine tuner who had any other goal, including lots of life. And I think it kind of comes out in a wash. I mean, it's like, yeah, for every possible combination of dial settings you could have, any particular combination of dial settings would be evidence for a fine tuner who preferred that combination and against a fine tuner who preferred all the other combinations. And I should say, I mean, that comment I was mentioning earlier, it's from my friend, Gareth, who is a good guy, interesting guy, but he says his objection to this argument is, okay, maybe all the microstates are equally possible, but only a tiny minority of the microstates will give rise to the macrostate of life existing. And so if we're thinking about this in terms of macrostates, then at least the disjunction of fine tuning in a multiverse makes sense again. To which I would just say, okay, but hold on. There are other macro states, right? Like, sure, if the one we're concerned with is life or no life, then yeah. But there are lots of other macro states where there are really unlikely combinations that this universe doesn't carry out. That if we had some other combination of dial settings, that it would be it was itself unlikely, because there are lots of different ways of dividing up macro states. Also, why are we assuming that a fine tuner's goals could only be macro state goals, right? Maybe a fine tuner just really likes some particular micro state for its own sake, that the fine tuner is passionate for this exact combination of some exact combination of dial settings. That doesn't make very much sense to us. But again, I don't know why we're assuming that if there's a God, it's a God who cares about the stuff we care about.
That was a summary. That was you summing up today, right?
Yeah.
Okay. What are you doing next week?
So definitely summed up today. So you asked me about next week. So yeah, let's do next week. Next week, next week's going to be about David Lewis. So since this week I kind of introduced Lewis before going into the physical multiverse and kind of laid down the marker on, okay, I think there's something that's like extremely suspect about the idea that you could show with philosophical arguments that all these possible worlds exist. Next week is going to be cashing that check, right? Next week is going to be saying, okay, well, let's actually look a little bit deeper at Lewis's arguments. Why don't I find those arguments convincing? You know, why do I think that there probably aren't any concrete possible worlds, or if there are, we wouldn't be in any position to know it.
Right. Cause I guess the multiverse ones are concrete world, and they're possible, like the physical world.
Yes.
But yeah, it's irrelevant. Yeah, so, it's relevant to his argument.
Yeah, exactly. So if there's a the many worlds interpretation of quantum physics is true, then all of those worlds, because part of what Lewis means by a world, right, is that it's everything's causally interconnected to everything else in the world. And so because there's a shared causal backstory, the collapse of the wave function, that, it's that there's a common origin of this and the other worlds. I believe technically Lewis would have to say that if he's right and the many worlds people are right, then that that multiverse is all part of the actual world.
Yeah. Oh, very nice. I probably am actually genuinely excited to talk more about David Lewis and possible concrete other worlds. I don't know how many other people in the world share that. But I guess in all the possible concrete worlds is an infinite number.
Yeah, exactly. So
imagine how many streams this video has got on the set of all possible worlds.
It's true. That's the it's just streaming these two channels in this world, but then you have like all of the possible worlds where at least those two channels exist and they're both streamed in, and then there are like a bunch of possible worlds where there are like 12 other podcasts that are also that are also streaming this chat right now. So yeah, if you go through like all of our listeners in all the different possible worlds, which for the record is how I think we should do it.
People are just debating in the chat now, like what bird is outside your window.
I don't know. My mom would be so ashamed. She's gotten really into bird watching in retirement, and I'm sure she could like instantly identify it. My inference is, oh, it sounds like a bird.
Yeah, me too. Me too. So let's knock off before I fall asleep on stream.
All right, sounds good.
Bye, everyone.